This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today on Takes on the World is Professor Sasan Fayez-Manesh. He's a professor emeritus of economics at Cal State University in Fresno. Born in Iran, he received his bachelor's and master's degrees in applied math from Cal State LA and UCLA, respectively, and went on to earn a PhD in economics at the University of California, Riverside campus. Dr. Fayez-Manesh's writings have appeared in such publications as the Journal of the History of Economic Thought, Research in the History of Economic Thought and Methodology, the Encyclopedia of Political Economy, and the Review of Radical Political Economics. He's the author of, quote, Confronting Iran, Obama's Policy of Tough Diplomacy, and more recently, a week ago, of an opinion piece on Counterpunch titled Trump, Iran, and the Fate of the JCPOA Nuclear Deal. Welcome to Takes on the World, Professor Fayez-Manesh.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Yesterday, you watched much of America, President Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, JCPOA. What should we think of his carefully prescripted performance?
It was expected that he would do that. He would pull out. The issue was, and it still remains, what kind of sanctions he would impose on Iran. And, of course, the script that he read was something written, and probably it was written by Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is basically an American-Israeli joint. I could basically see just about all the arguments that FDF usually makes, which basically means it was full of half-truths and lies and perhaps few truths here and there. So we can analyze it if you wish. I just have the transcript in front of me.
One thing that I know he repeated, as do all most pundits in the United States, is that they have to quickly establish that Iran is the leading state sponsor of terrorism, and the evidence they provide for it, they don't provide, actually. And then the destabilizing factor in the Middle East, totally ignoring the role that the U.S. invasion of Iraq had played, that the Saudis have played, that the overthrow of the government of Gaddafi in Libya played. Iran seems to be the main destabilizer. But again, it's a mantra you don't hear the proof of it.
Yes, actually, this was his second sentence, that Iran support terrorist proxies and militias such as Hezbollah, Hamas, Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. This is the direct quotation. Now, it is true that Iran supports Hezbollah and Hamas. These are opposition forces to Israelis. Hezbollah is now the biggest force in the Lebanese government. They just had an election, and it won the biggest seats in the Lebanese government. And Hamas is also a part of the Palestinian government in Gaza. So this was the truth part. Now, the other part, Taliban and Al-Qaeda, this was the lie part. Iran never supported Taliban. They indeed went to war with, almost went to war with Taliban before U.S. Invaded Afghanistan. And Iran has never supported Al-Qaeda, so these were lies.
Actually, the U.S. has supported Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria against the Syrian government, and even they've kind of apologized for that. And under the Obama administration, John Kerry said they were trying to dissuade the elements that the United States thought were the moderate elements from associating with the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Nusra Front. So it,
yes.
Perhaps
yes.
You comment on that.
Yes, Al-Qaeda received probably part of its money, not just from oil, but from Saudi Arabia, which is now the biggest body of Donald Trump. And so did at some point Taliban. And even ISIS, received some funds from Saudi Arabia. Again, that's a friend of the United States. So, yes, they did support these groups themselves. They are the enemies, of course, of Hezbollah and Hamas, because those, as I said, are the resistant forces against Israel. So, yes.
When you're in your article, which you wrote a week ago, on Trump, Iran, the fate of the JCPOA nuclear deal, you brought up the issue of whether it was important, with significance of changing key players in the White House, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and McMaster, who was a National Security Advisor, both of whom were for maintaining the Iran deal, with John Bolton, a super hawk for Israel, and Mike Pompeo, whose first visit when he became the CIA chief was to go to Saudi Arabia, and also an opponent of the deal. How significant and how important was it to get these people in place for Trump to then take the position he did yesterday, take the action he did yesterday?
As I mentioned in that article, these two individuals would support the, or bring about the worst instinct of Donald Trump. Bolton, in particular, has openly advocated attacking Iran or regime. Actually, yeah, attacking Iran. He has advocated regime change in Iran. He has appeared in front of an exile group called MEK, which stands for Mujahideen-e-Khalq-e-Iran. Has a long history, and we can go over this issue, which is very actually quite significant. A number of times he has appeared, Bolton has appeared in front of MEK gatherings and has talked about the regime change. This was only a few months ago. So, this is quite significant. These individuals have supported overthrowing the Iranian government and installing a government that is friendly with U.S. and Israel.
I recall when Bolton was U.N. ambassador, U.S.-American U.N. ambassador, Dan Gilliman, Israel's ambassador to the U.N., joked, in all seriousness, that Bolton had been the sixth man in Israel's U.N. office. And he certainly has proved his value to Israel, being part of PNAC and literally pushing for actual conflict, not a combination with all of Israel's enemies.
Yes, I wrote a book in 2006 about not just about Iran but also Iraq, and in that book I looked it up again, and the name of John Bolton appears more than 30 times. He was instrumental in pushing the U.S. towards invading Iraq. And he was such a hawk that I remember once he was nominated again by George Bush to the U.N. He wasn't confirmed. So he is a dangerous hawk. I don't watch Fox News, but apparently he was a commentator on that. And as I said, he worked very closely with a very crazy bunch of Iranian exiles who also work with Israel at the same time. And I should have actually mentioned this to you earlier, that lately, Rudolf Giuliani, Rudolf Giuliani also appeared in front of one of the meetings of MEK and promised that we will overthrow the Iranian government. So we are really dealing with quite dangerous individuals in the White House right now.
Well, we know that MEK was once on the U.S. terrorist list. It fought evidently with Iraq and Saddam Hussein against Iran in the war launched by Iraq on Iran back in 79. But then it suddenly got glossed over and got a paint job. And as you say, it appears MEK has full favor now in Washington. One thing is really interesting. It has not been a secret that Europe's allies, while not enamored with Iran, have really pushed and tried, at least to the extent that they're able, to keep the United States and President Trump from pulling out of the deal. How do you explain the difference between the U.S. position, or the position of the Trump administration, and the position of France, Britain, and Germany?
Well, of course, those countries don't have a crazy individual called Donald Trump as their leader. So that's understandable. But also, Europeans have quite a bit of dealing with Iran. for example, Airbus has been trying to sell planes to Iran to replace very dilapidated Iranian airliners that go back to 1970s, and they are quite dangerous. So Airbus has been trying to sell planes to Iran, and of course, so has Boeing. They had a $16 billion deal with Iran, which, as you probably heard this morning, it is going to be canceled. So Europeans have quite a bit of dealing with Iran, and they want to keep that. Iran is a large country, both geographically as well as population. It has about 80 million people. They're young. It looks like a gigantic market for them. So they would like to, they would have liked to keep JCPOA intact, but now they face problems. If Trump levies secondary sanctions against Iran, which basically means Europeans can't deal with Iran, then that is a major hurdle for them. If you want, of course, I can go into the history of sanctions and these secondary sanctions, but just very briefly, secondary sanctions were imposed on Iran in during the Clinton era in 1990s, which basically meant any country that deals with Iran for something like more than $20 million would be subject to U.S. sanctions as well. These sanctions were intensified under Obama administration as well. And so those were removed during the nuclear negotiation. And now, of course, Donald Trump would like to bring them back.
Well, the secondary sanctions are really important because most Americans aren't aware of them. I spoke about them on my program before. But what essentially is not only, it seems, the U.S. sanctioning Iran, but they're sanctioning the entire world, any country that wants to have dealings. And even Boeing, this is a major contract. And as I heard, Steven Mnuchin made this statement this morning that Boeing cannot fulfill that contract, and that's going to cause a major shakeup in that country and among its workers. There's no question about that.
If I may add, sure. Yes. These sanctions that they are levying and or they are going to levy, and what he said this morning about Boeing, would also apply to Airbus, European Airbus, because many of the parts that Airbus uses are made in the United States, which basically means that Airbus is going to have a hard time selling planes to Iran as well.
Well, thanks for bringing that in. As a matter of fact, the one of the problems also is that most foreign companies at some time or another have to deal with U.S. banks. And those, when last I heard, were controlled by a special department in the Treasury that was established under George Bush, W. Bush, which seems to be controlled by extremely pro-Israel individuals who they determine what countries, companies and countries would be sanctioned, as well as what organization would be declared terrorist. And maybe you could comment on that.
Well, yes, of course. One of the most important things that the Obama administration did, and actually happened during his administration, it happened in the Congress and then Obama carried it forward, was to sanction the Central Bank of Iran. This was unheard of. As an economist, I'd never heard a foreign central bank being sanctioned by a country, which basically means that it would paralyze the economy of that country. It would paralyze the banking system of that country. So that's what Obama did. And this morning there is talk of once again sanctioning the central bank of Iran, which means that most banks in Iran cannot deal with outside banks. So yes, this might happen very easily. We have to wait and see whether they are going to intend to bring something called CISADA, which was an act in 2011 that passed the Congress, and the issue of sanctioning central bank was brought up. And then Obama supported it as well. So this is going to be quite dangerous and paralyzing for the Iranian economy.
One of the things that is most frightening is the prospect of another war. Now, Israel has been attacking what appears to be Iranian soldiers' bases in Syria, while at the same time making big headlines about worrying about the threat of Iran retaliation. It seems that Israel is actually looking for a war with Iran because it believes that it will be back to the hilt by the United States as well as the Saudis, et cetera. What do you think of his decision yesterday? Has to do, was it move us closer to a war? Or certainly it wouldn't have seemed to move it away from it, but what do you think the prospects of another devastating war in the Middle East are?
I have argued for a long time that Israel considered two countries to be standing in its way as far as annexation of the West Bank is concerned. These two countries were Saddam Hussein's Iraq and then, of course, Iran. And they got rid of Saddam Hussein and they devastated Iraq's economy. Iraq is basically gone as a force as far as Israel is concerned. And after overthrowing Saddam Hussein, they started to really concentrate on Iran. So yes, their aim is regime change, as they usually call it, through force, which basically means ultimately attacking Iran. But they have, of course, always wanted the United States to do their war for them. So they seem to be trying to push Trump in that direction, which of course take us back to this last week's show that Netanyahu had about discovering 55,000 pages of documents related to Iran nuclear weapon issues and all that, which was, by the way, actually mentioned by Donald Trump yesterday as well. So if you wish, we can go over some of the details of that as well.
Well, Perhaps we can, because one of the things that most Americans may not be aware of, that there are many Iranian Jews emigrated to Israel. Shaul Mofaz, a former defense minister, I believe was Iranian, and he said after the attack on Iraq, the U.S. attacked Iraq, he says, now when are you going to go after Syria and Iran? So what would be the possibility of some of these documents being forged by Iranian Israelis, who are, of course, familiar with Farsi, it was their language, and just in case they need to show these to the world, they've had plenty of time to do this. But what's the prospects of that, you think?
Well, I actually wrote quite a bit on the documents that he was talking about, and not too many people mentioned the history of these documents. He didn't tell us exactly what these documents are. He highlighted some of them, And as far as the highlights were concerned, I thought I have heard all of this before. And most people who know something about these documents, they all said that there was really nothing new in this. These were some documents, or at least the ones that he mentioned, that were supposedly discovered in 2004 by the United States on a laptop that mysteriously fell on their lap. They mentioned it in 2005. They have a laptop which has over 1,000 pages of material related to designing nuclear bomb. And everything that you heard from Netanyahu was already in there. So at the time, the issue was in 2005 whether these so-called laptop or the material were fabricated by Israel, and they were distributed by them via MEK to the United States. I remember even the head of IAEA, International Atomic Agency, El Baradei at the time, said that he doubts the authenticity of this material. But then, of course, CIA claimed that they are authentic. So, lo and behold, Netanyahu is using it again. This time he claims that there are 55,000 of such pages, as opposed to a few thousand that they had mentioned earlier. Nothing about what he said made sense about the so-called warehouse in Iran, which, as some people pointed out, he was using pictures that were 2 years old, as far as Google map is concerned. As some people pointed out in New York Times, apparently on that building that he mentioned, or warehouse that he mentioned, there were no locks. And people laugh at all of this. But apparently this was designed to be used by Donald Trump yesterday, and it was indeed used.
Well,
there's, of course, a lot more to say about this laptop story and what was in it, but I don't want to probably go into the details for your audience.
My guest today is Sasan Fayaz-Menash. We are talking about President Trump's decision to end U.S. participation in the nuclear agreement with Iran. And you were listening to it on Takes on the World on KZYX, where the time is now 9:46. One of the things that seems to be important in terms of this kind of show and tell is that, again, like the UN, we're told that it was a ton of material or half a ton of material. But there are no pictures of this ton of material, how they supposedly got this out of Iran. The story that the Israelis put out has not been said to be alleged. It has been accepted as a fact. When Netanyahu makes a claim that Israel had stolen this or filtered this or managed to find this because Mossad is the most brilliant intelligence agency in the world, and it is accepted as the claims accepted without any questioning, and this seems to be universal for anything that has to deal with Iran, Hezbollah, a criticism of Syria, or the Russians these days, alleged disappears, the term disappears, when an enemy of the U.S. government is the subject. Maybe you could comment on that lack of questioning of government sources.
It is true. Most of the time, they don't question anything that U.S. or Israel tells them. But in this particular case, I have to say that just about everything that I saw, even in places that usually support the U.S. government and Israel, such as New York Times and Washington Post, people did raise questions because it made very little sense what he was saying. These, some of the material that he was mentioning, for example, he mentioned something called AMAD, A-M-A-D, program, which I had followed very closely, and he mentioned somebody, some Iranian nuclear physicist by the name of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which I had followed that case very, very closely. He just mentioned these issues, and these issues have already been settled with IAEA. IAEA published a report in 2010, I believe, which told Iran that you need to answer these specific set of questions about the material on the laptop. And when there was this JCPOA meeting, IAEA established a mechanism which was called the roadmap, in which they sat down with Iran and they went over all this material. And there was no conclusive result. Iran did not admit to these material. They did mention that some of the documents seem to be valid, but they really have nothing to do with developing nuclear weapons. And eventually IAEA said, well, we have resolved it all. It's settled. It's finished. We closed the case. So what the Netanyahu is trying to do is to bring it all back again. As I said, not too many people, even in Washington Post and New York Times, took this dog and pony show very seriously. It really didn't have much of an effect, except for what Donald Trump did yesterday, just to mention it as a support for what he was doing.
It's interesting. You did mention there the press response. The New York Times today has four articles. Susan Rice, who served under Obama, Roger Cohen, the columnist. Susan Rice said it's the most reckless act yet of Trump. Roger Cohen said it proves the U.S. word is worthless. Nick Kristof, a columnist, said it's vandalism, not foreign policy. Uniquely defending it was Brett Stevens, a neocon who wrote for years, probably a dual Israeli-U.S. citizen. He wrote for years for the Israeli press and then went to the Wall Street Journal and then was picked up to be an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He argued that this deal was not even our deal, that the deal that Trump nixed, that was never sent to Congress, obviously, because Congress was under the thumb of the Israel lobby and AIPAC and would never have approved it. So he's trying to argue there was no legal basis to this deal, and yet the person who's doing it is obviously unabashedly pro-Israel. So it just shows you these two camps, even those who are normally hawks or not known as peaceniks in the U.S. media have questioned it. But what that is going to lead to, we can't tell now. One thing that is important is what is going to happen to the Iranian economy, even despite the deal. It never was able to exploit the advantages of the JCPOA because there was always these threats and secondary sanctions, warnings by the United States of certain elements here that companies doing business with Iran had better be careful. So even during this period, the last couple of years, there have been warnings to Iranian or European companies not to do business with Iran. And the economy there is not in good shape. So maybe you could comment on what that possibility is going to be for Iran in this current upcoming time.
Yes, I had always argued that removing the sanctions would be necessary for some sort of improvement in Iran's economy, but it wouldn't be sufficient because there was quite a bit of mismanagement. As an economist, I usually follow what the Central Bank of Iran does and the banking system in Iran and all that. So I could see all the problems that exist. Even setting aside the issues. Nevertheless, it was necessary to remove these sanctions to start some sort of reform in the Iran's economy. But as you mentioned, these sanctions, even though formally they were removed, for all practical purposes, were there. Obama administration, we haven't really discussed their policies, but they were quite tricky themselves. They did remove formally the sanctions. Nevertheless, they did not help the Iranian economy to improve. In other words, they threw obstacles in front of Iran, one after another, and the banking system continued to face troubles, including something called SWIFTs and so on and so forth, which basically does not really allow them to deal with too many banks around the world. So the Obama administration made it very hard for the Iranian economy to improve. And they made foreign firms that wanted to deal with Iran very scared that they might be punished one way or another. And of course, once these gang came into power, the Trump gang, things became worse. Many countries around the world, or companies around the world, are still quite scared of dealing with Iran. And of course, if they were always scared that secondary sanctions might be reimposed again. And of course, if they are, then they have to pull out of Iran. You can either deal with the U.S. or deal with Iran. And U.S. is more lucrative, more powerful, and all that. So you have to eventually pull out of Iran.
How do you think the European countries are going to respond? Is there any way, are they going to roll over eventually because the U.S. is more powerful?
This has happened before. As I said, the Clinton administration imposed secondary sanctions on Iran. And at the beginning, almost all countries that dealt with Iran defied it. But eventually, the pressure was so much that they started to follow. If they do impose secondary sanctions, this morning I was actually listening to the news, and one of the advisors to Trump was talking about ILSA. ILSA was Iran-Libya Sanction Act, which was passed in 1995. They threw Libya in there after they had decided they want to sanction Iran, secondary sanctions. And of course, they eventually took Libya out. But he was talking about ILSA. This was all before the issue of nuclear weapons and anything like that. They had imposed secondary sanctions. And this guy was saying, well, we are going to bring back ILSA. So in other words, it has nothing to do whatsoever with nuclear issues. They want to bring secondary sanctions. And again, once they do bring them, the countries around the world have to decide whether they are going to deal with the U.S. or they are going to deal with Iran. And I'm sure they will go with the U.S. So,
I'm not that hopeful.
Yes. They are already talking this morning. I was reading some European headlines, and they were saying that they are going to defy the U.S. They are going to meet Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif next week to iron out issues and all that. But I'm not really that helpful that if the Trump administration puts pressure on them, they will not bend again.
One thing I should bring up is we're hearing also at the same time the wonderful, I'm quoting it, progress that the U.S. is making towards sitting down with North Korea. I noted North Korea is not on the agenda of the Israel or the Israel lobby in this country. It seems like they could get away with sitting down with North Korea, but is this a diversion, like a bait and switch? And what message does this Trump's decision send to North Korea if they actually plan to have an agreement with the United States?
You actually mentioned something very interesting. As far as U.S. and North Korea are concerned, there is an an important element missing, and that is Israel. Israel has no bones with to deal with North Korea. So that's a very important issue. The two negotiations, if you wish, are very unsimilar. North Korea has nuclear weapons, and they are going to be dealing with the U.S. from a position of relative strength. Iran never had nuclear weapons, and they had always said that they weren't really developing nuclear weapons. So they entered negotiation from a position of really weakness. And as far as I said, right after the negotiation was concluded and JCPOA entered, I said that the deal was flawed. Not in the sense that Trump is not talking about, in the sense that it left so many holes as far as this deal is.
We've come to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.